We're very proud to do this program tonight with Scott Ritter and with Karen Mack, who's an activist who just returned from a battleground in Miami around the free trade area of the Americas. So I think we have an opportunity to hear two outstanding presentations tonight that have to do with the issue of globalization, one form of globalization and of kind of empire building done through the economic sphere and the other done through the military sphere. And they're very much connected. And we're privileged to kind of hear some excellent presentations about that tonight. I would like to give, before we start, I'd really like to thank the folks from People of Color Against Globalization who helped do this program tonight, who've secured the site for us. This was donated to us by Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, and we really appreciate that, them giving us this incredible space. It's got incredible acoustics, and it's really, I think, a really good place to have this kind of a conversation. And I would like to thank all of the folks from the Topanga Peace Alliance who co-sponsored this with People of Color Against Globalization. People of Color Against Globalization is a network of activists who are working to build an anti-corporate globalization movement in communities of color. And we think that's important because on a world scale, it's primarily the people of color throughout the world, the people of the global south, who are spearheading the fight against corporate globalization. And corporate globalization has a consequence for all of us in the environment, in the economy, in politics, in this military sphere. It has consequences for everything. And in our communities, in oppressed communities of color, we've been experiencing globalization for 500 years. This is nothing new to us. The idea of privatization began with stealing the communal lands of the native peoples. That was the first incidence of privatization that happened in North America, where European settlers began to take what had been common lands, the communal lands of the native indigenous peoples, and to take those over and turn them into private holdings. So this idea of privatizing what has been common property is not something that's really unique and not something that's new. It has a new form. It has a new a power behind it. But it's clearly something that in our communities we've experienced from day one. Military conquest, you know, the military conquest of the native peoples, the annexation of Mexico, the forcible enslavement of Africans, the fact that Chinese coolie labor was brought over after the slave trade was outlawed, they used the slave ships to bring over Chinese coolie labor to perform a kind of neo-slave labor in building the railroads here in this country. So there's a real precedent in our community of experiencing globalization, but also of resistance to globalization. A very powerful, I think, creative and profound kind of resistance that has a really essential democratic and a kernel of social justice, which I think has been there from the beginning of our struggles. So what we want to do now is to challenge the current manifestations of corporate globalization by building a movement in our communities that's connected with the kinds of struggles that we're fighting every day, again, for jobs, for immigrants' rights, for union rights, for educational justice, for health justice, for an end to police brutality and INS harassment and racism against our communities. So we're trying to connect with the very day-to-day fights of our people for human dignity, for social justice, for human rights. We're trying to connect that with this larger worldwide movement for a sense of global justice. And that's what we're trying to do. That's our endeavor. I think it's a very important project. And it's something new. It really is an experiment. And people from different communities are coming together and trying to build a kind of unified perspective that also recognizes the very particular diversity of our communities. And we're also very glad to reach out our hands to the non-communities of color, to the Anglo-European communities, to the peace communities, to the non-intervention communities, to the environmental communities, and say, join us in this common effort to achieve a world of global justice. So that's part of what we want to do this program tonight, so we can look at two kind of elements of corporate globalization and begin to have a better understanding of that. And with that understanding, we can begin to do something about it. So I really appreciate your being here, and I really appreciate your support for this endeavor. And now I'd like to introduce Scott Ritter. As we know, this is another person who was willing to take a courageous stand and to tell the truth, really. These days, speaking the truth takes a lot of courage. And what he did was he reported on what he saw, what he found, what he was able to assess when he was working for the United Nations as a weapons inspector in Iraq. And he, for that, for putting forward this truth, prior to the invasion of Iraq, he was vilified, he was attacked by the government, by the media. And you would think that now that what he said has been verified post-invasion, no weapons of mass destruction, no biological weapons, no chemical weapons, no nuclear weapons, no capability of destroying our country within 45 minutes, as Tony Blair was saying, you would think that he would be all over the media, that he would be the star of Fox Television, the star of MSNBC, the star of Ted Koppel. But yet we still see this kind of effort to kind of exclude the truth from the people of this country. So it's really a privilege for us, for him to be here tonight to share with us his perspectives. And he's going to be here to talk a little bit about his new book, which is here called Frontier Justice, and he's going to be signing the book afterwards. So I really encourage everyone to buy the thing, to read it, and to get it out to other people. Let's give it up for Scott Ritter.
If I had my preference, there wouldn't be a war in Iraq. And there wouldn't be a reason for me to standing before you here tonight. But unfortunately, the situation is what the situation is. We find ourselves 9 months into an occupation of a sovereign country that, while ruled by a brutal dictator, posed no threat to the United States of America worthy of military intervention. I probably don't need to highlight this, but I will just to show you what's transpiring here tonight, unless, in case you haven't quite caught on to it. How many registered Republicans are sitting here in the church tonight? Well, you got one standing here before you. How many people here voted for George W. Bush for the President of the United States? Well, you got one here standing before you. How many 12-year veterans of the United States Marine Corps who fought in Desert Storm do you have here today? Well, you got one standing here before you. And the point I'm trying to make here is that we come from different backgrounds. We probably come from different political ideologies. But we're united in one thing. And we are citizens of the United States of America. And we do believe in something that is good and just. We believe in the concepts of liberty and justice for all. We believe in peace and justice. We believe in the values and ideals that define this country. And we are concerned that the country we live in has deviated significantly from those values and ideals. We, the people of the United States of America, we are the government. We are that which defines this nation. And we collectively have a problem. And that problem, I think, manifests itself in Iraq. You know, this has not been a nation that has been built on perfection. Not at any time in our nation's history can you say that we were perfect. We were formed in a flawed fashion. A nation that espoused liberty and justice for all but still endorsed slavery. A nation that didn't give women the right to vote till a century later. A nation that still struggles to come to grips with concepts of human rights, civil liberties, here at home, in our own country, let alone the concept of exporting American democracy abroad. We haven't cobbled together the perfect vision of democracy here at home, and yet, we stand for something good in this country. And we have great potential. And I've always been one who believes that the duties and responsibilities of a citizen is to take a critical look at the country that you live in and identify problems when you see them, and then undertake that which is necessary to rectify these problems. And I was one of these people that naively believed that we had a solid foundation upon which we were building something good. And that when we're talking about fixing this country, we're talking about cosmetic fixtures. Maybe fixing a broken window here. Maybe fixing a door that's a little ajar there. Doing a little sanding here, a little painting there. But ladies and gentlemen, when we reflect on Iraq and what's happening in Iraq today, I'm here to tell you right now, the foundation of this country is flawed. And we will never, ever build anything worthy of the promise of the United States until we fix this foundation. The United States of America today is a nation that is ill. It is a diseased country. We are sick. And we can't talk about fixing things by addressing the symptoms. We have to address the disease. And ladies and gentlemen, the disease is us. We are the problem, and Iraq is a manifestation of this problem. When we think about why we're in Iraq, we were told by the President of the United States that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction that not only violated international law, but posed a grave and imminent threat to the security of the United States and indeed the security of the entire world. Now, the president said this not in a speculative fashion. He said it using words such as, "I know these weapons to exist." Now, I may be a simple Marine, but when someone says that they know something, that implies certainty of knowledge. That means that there is a baseline of factual data that the president is relying on. And here we are 9 months into the occupation, and how many weapons of mass destruction have been uncovered in Iraq? None. And I'm here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that they will not uncover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That the entire basis for this war was a fraud. The president lied to us, and yet this was not a lie that should only manifest itself 9 months into an occupation. It was a lie that was as plain as the nose on your face. The president never provided any factual data to sustain his allegations that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. You will not find a single United Nations report that says Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction or has reconstituted a production base to produce weapons of mass destruction. What you'll hear from the United Nations is that they cannot verify with absolute certainty Iraq's assertions that all weapons of mass destruction have been destroyed, that the United Nations cannot confirm this, that there are still gaps in the understanding about the totality of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, and therefore the United Nations is unable to close the book on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. You know, I endorse that. I endorse that. Iraq was a nation that had possessed massive quantities of weapons of mass destruction. Iraq is a nation that, when called upon by the international community to disarm, chose not to, lied, concealed, dissimulated, obstructed the work of the inspectors. Therefore, when Iraq suddenly comes up and declares disarmament by dictate, "Yes, we lied to you, but we now have no weapons of mass destruction," they don't deserve the benefit of the doubt. Their words must be backed up with verifiable, substantive fact, and until which time that is done, it would be irresponsible to declare Iraq free of weapons of mass destruction. But there's a big difference between saying we cannot confirm that Iraq has destroyed all of its weapons of mass destruction and saying that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction that constitute a threat. The president said that he knew Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction, and yet he provided no data to back this up. Congress of the United States, remember, we live in a democracy that's based upon three separate but equal branches of government. The president and his administration constitute the executive branch. But then there are the people's representatives, the congressmen and women, the senators, whom we elect to represent us, who are responsible for providing appropriate checks and balances to the President of the United States so that executive power does not become dictatorial power in this democratic republic we call the United States of America. And what did Congress do? How many of our brave representatives raised their hand and said, "Excuse me, Mr. President, could you back up what you're saying with data?" Very few. Tragically, you can count them on your hands. One of them is Dennis Kucinich. A brave man, a man who from the very beginning questioned this war. How many people listened to Dennis Kucinich? None. How many people are listening to Dennis Kucinich today? Not too many. How many people should be listening to Dennis Kucinich? Every single American out there. But it's not happening. What did Congress do? Did they stand up for the rights of the American people? Did they inadequately represent us? No. Congress abrogated their constitutional responsibilities when it comes to war. The founders, the framers of this nation, the United States of America, clearly set forth in the Constitution that defines us as a people, as a nation, that the power to declare war is that of the Congress of the United States, not the President of the United States. And the reason why they gave it to Congress is so that it would be a difficult decision to make. So that Congress would have to reflect on the price their constituencies would pay should we go to war. And what did Congress do? Did they stand up and ask the president hard questions and demand hard answers? No, they punted. Congress voted to transfer war powers authority to the President of the United States before the President of the United States publicly declared his intention to go to war. Imagine that. An absolute dereliction of duty. But if that's not bad enough, there's the media. The fourth estate, you know, the watchdog of American democracy. The brave reporters who are supposed to go out there and inform the public. Hold Congress accountable. Hold the president accountable. By publishing the truth, discussing the truth. But what did the media do? Stood there and spoon-fed the president's lies in Congress's dereliction of duty to the American people. Where was the media asking the tough questions? I'll give you a little anecdote. You know, in September of 2002, I went to Baghdad. Ann Coulter, brave defender of American freedom that she is, has belittled this trip, saying that it was un-American for me to go to Baghdad. Yeah, it was pretty un-American of me to go to Baghdad, I guess. It's un-American to go to Iraq and demand of the Iraqi government full and total compliance with Security Council resolutions, telling the Iraqi government that they had no choice but to give in to the Security Council's resolutions, the Security Council's demand for the return of weapons inspectors, that Iraq had no right to put forward preconditions for the return of inspectors, that if Iraq didn't allow the inspectors back in, Iraq would face total annihilation. It was un-American of me to tell the Iraqis that truth is on their side. They should not be afraid of the truth. If they have no weapons of mass destruction, then let the inspectors back in and truth will out. How naive I was. How utterly un-American I was to believe that truth will out. And that's what I did in Baghdad. I basically tried to open the door for a venue to resolve the situation between Iraq and the international community that would not lead to renewed military conflict. How un-American of me. I spoke to the Iraqi National Assembly on September 8th. On September 13th, Saddam Hussein agreed to allow inspectors back in, thereby opening the door for the possibility of resolving this situation peacefully. I came back to the United States and got a kind invitation from CNN to go to their headquarters and meet with their executives and their senior talking heads, basically 60 people in a crammed office space. They wanted to find out if I was some sort of wacko that was off his rocker and therefore not worthy of appearing on CNN's screens, or if there was some credibility or some legitimacy. So for an hour and 45 minutes, I was grilled by CNN on the position I took on Iraq. How do I respond to this centrifuge program, these aluminum tubes that I had the gall to say belonged to artillery rockets? It's not as though I only spent 7 years in Iraq inspecting these 81-millimeter artillery tubes, knowing for absolute certainty that they were related artillery rockets, that they have nothing to do with the centrifuge program that I also investigated. No, I shouldn't dare speak the truth to the American people, especially on CNN's airwaves, lest they be embarrassed. Lest you have Paul Azan accuse me of drinking from Saddam's Kool-Aid. For an hour and 45 minutes, they asked me questions, and I was able to back up everything I said with documents and with statements of fact. And at the end, the CEO of CNN stood up and said that while he didn't agree with everything I said from a political standpoint, factually he couldn't contest it. And then he turned like the Pope to his assembled media people and said, "I certify Mr. Ritter as a source worthy of use. Feel free to use him on your programming." And now that I've been suitably blessed, he turned to me and said, "Do you have any questions of us?" I said, "Just one." You held me up here for an hour and 45 minutes and you asked me all sorts of questions that I found somewhat demeaning and insulting, but I answered your questions. I proved that what I said has merit. So my question to you is, why do you dare question a 7-year veteran of the weapons inspection process about weapons of mass destruction when the President of the United States opens his mouth and you publish it without question? You have a double standard. You demand that I back up what I say, but when the President says something, you don't ask a single question. When are you going to start asking the President questions? When are you going to start asking his administration questions? Why do you merely just parrot their words? To which they had no answer. None whatsoever. So let's blame the media too as part of this diseased nation. But, ladies and gentlemen, here comes the toughest pill to swallow. Because when you take a look at the Constitution of the United States and the preamble of the Constitution, it doesn't say the President of the United States all-powerful. It doesn't say the Congress of the United States all-knowing. It doesn't say that it is the responsibility of the media to inform the people. It says we, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union. Ladies and gentlemen, the biggest symptom of the disease that afflicts this nation is us. We, the people. We're the problem because we're this country. And when we look at Iraq, Iraq is a manifestation of what ails us as a people. We didn't ask the President to back up his words about weapons of mass destruction. Oh yeah, we did a couple demonstrations in the street. Weren't we wonderful? 200,000 people in the streets of New York City, and what good did it do? Once the bullets started flying, the people stopped walking. When people hijack the American flag on their lapels when they sit on TV and claim that the only patriot is somebody who supports the troops, somebody like George W. Bush, who avoided war, ran away from combat when it was his turn to serve, and yet had the gall to stand before the American people and say, "Bring them on," when talking about the Iraqi resistance. A man who didn't have the courage to fly a fighter airplane over Vietnam, but certainly had the courage to let somebody land him on an aircraft carrier so he could strut around in full military regalia, declaring an end to a war that is still raging in Iraq. You know, you got people on the streets waving the American flag, saying they're patriotic. Waving a flag doesn't make you patriotic. I can train a monkey to wave a flag, and that doesn't make that monkey patriotic. A patriot's somebody who can read the Constitution of the United States of America and live the Constitution of the United States of America. And we haven't done that collectively. Might have a few good citizens out there that have, but collectively we have failed to act in accordance with the responsibilities that the founding fathers of this nation transferred to us. We're responsible for what goes on here. We didn't ask the president questions. We're not holding Congress accountable, and we aren't doing anything to hold the media accountable for what they've done, and we're damn sure not holding ourselves accountable for our failure, our collective failure that is Iraq today. We're in Iraq. Is it about weapons of mass destruction? No, ladies and gentlemen, it's not. Is it about oil? It's not that simple. What it's about is American arrogance. The concept that the United States of America has some sort of God-given right to dictate to the entire world how it should live in a manner which best benefits we, the people of the United States. It's about American imperialism. It's about global hegemony. The war in Iraq is the first step of a larger process of transforming the Middle East into something that's more digestible by we, the people of the United States of America. You see, we're threatened by the concept of people who don't look like us, people who don't worship like us, people who don't talk like us. We're going to transform the Middle East, which means we're going to transform the Muslim world. Ladies and gentlemen, think of the arrogance of that statement. Think of the criminality of that statement. And think of your silence when Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld sit before the United States Senate and say just those same words. Why are we in Iraq? Because Iraq is the first phase of a larger struggle to transform the Middle East into an area that's more suitable for American-style democracy. You show me where in international law this is something that's permitted. I'll show you in international law where it's not permitted. I'll show you a little document called the United Nations Charter, of which we're a signatory. And then I'll refer you back to the Constitution of the United States of America. You see, Article 6 of the Constitution is very clear. When we, the people of the United States of America, and our elected representatives sign a treaty or enter into an international agreement that has been ratified by 2/3 of the United States Senate, it is the law of the land. We have signed the United Nations Charter. It has been ratified. It is a binding legal agreement. And yet we have a president, when confronted by a reporter just the other day about the potential illegalities of some of our economic dealings vis-a-vis Iraq, said, international law? I guess I better consult a lawyer on this one. No one ever told me about this. And he thought it was funny. When a president mocks international law, the president is mocking the Constitution, and therefore the president is mocking us, we, the people. What are we doing about it? What are we doing about it? Iraq is a manifestation of centuries of failure by the people of the United States to uphold the vision and promise of this great nation. We the people have stopped being citizens. We the people have instead become consumers who have wrapped ourselves in a cocoon of comfort. And so long as the powers that be keep us waddling down a relative path of prosperity, we are hesitant to rock the boat, lest the prosperity end. But we've forgotten that it's our responsibility to rock the boat, that we're the ones that have to hold people accountable for what they do in our name. And when we fail to do so, we cease to function as a democratic republic. Democratic republic. That's what we're supposed to be. Oligarchy. Fascism. One is where we are today, the other is the direction we're heading. Oligarchy, concentration of power in the hands of a few. That's where we are today. We're not a democratic republic. We have ceded our responsibilities. We have ceded our authority. We have ceded our power to a power elite who govern in accordance with our addiction to a lifestyle that we cannot sustain except on the backs of others, non-Americans, people out there who have resources that we need at prices or that are convenient to us. And then this oligarchy takes it a step further, a confluence of corporate and national interests that uses war to promote national virility. The classic definition from Benito Mussolini of fascism. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't see a nation today under the leadership of President George W. Bush that defines a nation's virility through its military, then you must be blind. We have a president today that doesn't export democracy, he exports American military divisions. He's a president that shoots first and asks questions later. He's a president that likens himself as a cowboy, sort of a vision of the old West. You know, I got no problems with cowboys. They're sort of neat people. They get up early in the morning, they get on their horse, and they ride out there and they herd the cattle. They repair the fences. They're honorable people. They don't make that much money. And so things are valuable to them that can't be defined in terms of a price, like friendship, honor, integrity. Cowboys are the kind of people that would ride 60 miles in a blizzard to deliver food to a neighbor that needed food. Cowboys are people that'll stay up all night to help a colicky horse to make sure that horse recovers. Cowboys are good people. George W. Bush ain't no cowboy. He calls himself, likes himself to be like a sheriff. He's bringing justice to the world. You know? Because we got some bad people out there. We got evil doers. And we need to bring justice. We got a frontier out there. You know what a frontier is? Frontier is that area between civilization, i.e. America, and the wilderness, the rest of the world. And you got the frontier where the rule of law doesn't always apply because it can't, because you got bad guys running around. So you need frontier justice. You need a tough, steely-eyed marshal to come riding in there and bring the law down to civilize the wilderness. And that's George W. Bush, ladies and gentlemen. The steely-eyed marshal riding in on his white horse, bringing justice at the end of a pistol. It's a tough thing bringing justice sometimes. You got bad guys like Black Bart, also known as Saddam Hussein, the cattle rustler, or the proliferator of weapons of mass destruction. And he's in jail. And he's been stealing cattle, i.e. proliferating weapons of mass destruction, for some time now. And we're waiting for the circuit judge to come in and try this guy, also known as the United Nations. That circuit judge, though, he's drunk. He's holed up in a whorehouse in New Orleans. He's not going to come around for a long time because he's useless. And we don't have time to wait for traditional justice. So George W. Bush kicked down the jail cell, dragged Black Bart out there, and strung him up by the neck until he was dead. And then while his feet are still twitching, desperately looks around for evidence of the cattle that he allegedly rustled and didn't find any. Frontier justice, ladies and gentlemen. Is that what we want? George W. Bush isn't even a sheriff, though. See, a sheriff's somebody that'll come up and stare you in the eyes, at least tell you right to your face, I accuse you of doing something, I'm going to take you on. Go for your gun. Bush doesn't have the courage to stare anybody in the face and say, go for your gun. Bush is a bushwhacker. A bushwhacker, ladies and gentlemen. You know what a bushwhacker is? It's the most cowardly form of combat you can imagine from the Old West. The bushwhacker is somebody who waits up behind a bush, behind a stone, lets somebody ride by, and then shoots them in the back without warning. Bushwhacker's a liar, a cheat, a thief. And that's what we got. A president who's willing to violate not only international law, but the Constitution of the United States, the very values and ideals that define who we are as a people, and doesn't even have the courage to tell it to us in our face. President Bush is symptomatic of the disease that besets this country. Iraq and the policies of the Bush administration in Iraq are symptomatic of the disease. But the real disease is the people who sustain this president, the people who sustain this policy. It's high time we stand up and say, no, we the people aren't going to take it anymore. When was the last time you held your congressman or woman accountable for his or her vote on the war on Iraq? How many people went up and said, wait a minute, why are you continuing to fund this war to the tune of $87 billion when we haven't found any weapons of mass destruction? I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but no offense to anybody here. Look how many people are in this room. We're in the city of Los Angeles, the city of angels. And how many people really give a damn about what's happening in Iraq? Not too many. Why? Because they aren't citizens. They're consumers. So you want to move forward here, we got to talk about solving or curing the disease, not just the symptoms. Yeah, you can go out in the streets and you can protest the war in Iraq. You're just addressing the symptom. You got to cure the disease. You got to find a way to motivate people to break free of their cocoon of comfort, bring them in here so they can collectively address these problems. Strength in numbers, ladies and gentlemen, that's what makes this country great. People who believe in something. But how many people have actually read the Constitution? How many people live the Constitution? You can't live a document you're unfamiliar with. And if you don't think the Constitution is important, then you don't deserve the title of American citizen. The Constitution defines who we are as a people. And when you don't know the Constitution, then you don't know where to go when those whom we elect to office to represent us start deviating from the Constitution. When they start implementing Patriot Acts or Patriot Act IIs. When they start detaining American citizens and putting them in military prisons and denying them access to lawyers. When they start invading nations in violation of international law. When they deploy the sons and daughters of our country who honor us by wearing the uniform of the armed services of the United States of America abroad to commit war crimes. Ladies and gentlemen, our men and women are committing war crimes on a daily basis. The occupation of Iraq is in and of itself a war crime. To sit there and to pursue a tribunal to prosecute the former members of the regime of Saddam Hussein at this point in time is a war crime. It's a violation of the Geneva Accord. An occupying power cannot pass and implement laws. That is the responsibility of a sovereign government, and there is no sovereign government. An occupying power cannot sell the economic assets of a nation, and yet we are doing that as we speak. And because the war in Iraq has gone bad for us, other things are happening. Assassinations done in the name of the United States. We are crossing the borders into Syria, into Iran, bringing the war into those countries. This situation is spinning out of control, ladies and gentlemen. We're not going to fix the problem in Iraq. We've lost this war. We cannot win this war. All we can do is mitigate the damage that's been done. And the only way we can mitigate that is to get the troops out now. There's no reason or justification for continued military presence in Iraq. But even when the troops come home, if we don't do something to address the conditions which got those troops to deploy to begin with, all we're going to do is buy time until the next country we invade. So, what do we do? That's the hardest question of all. What do we do? And I don't have an answer for that, except the following. Go home, and every morning you wake up, look in the mirror and say, are you doing everything you can to promote active citizenship? Because that is the only way we're going to cure this disease. Active citizenship by every American out there. It doesn't mean that they're going to agree with your particular political ideology. I consider myself an active citizen. And I guarantee you that if we sat down across the table and started discussing, you know, our opinion on certain policies, we would disagree. But disagreement's healthy. It's great. You know, when you look at the birth of our country, Thomas Jefferson was sort of the radical progressive liberal of his time. John Adams was sort of the raving, you know, Ann Coulter type right winger. And they didn't agree on anything. If Thomas Jefferson had gotten his way on everything he wanted, we wouldn't have the United States of America. The same thing if John Adams had gotten away with everything. But the two didn't. They had to come together. They negotiated, they debated, they fought, they struggled. And the compromises they struck, although not perfect, made this country a better place. That's citizenship. And what we need are Americans to become good citizens, to have the courage to sit down and confront one another about the issues, to get informed, to empower themselves with knowledge and information so that they cannot be intimidated by fear and ignorance. Be good citizens, ladies and gentlemen. Be good citizens, cure the disease, and help make this country live up to the wonderful potential that is found in the words of the Constitution of the United States. We, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union. Let's start working on making that union more perfect. Thank you very much.
My name is Hop Hopkins, and I'm part of People of Color Against Globalization. And this is our second event, and we're so happy to have Karen and Scott here. And I'd just like to say that we are a small network of people of color, from various ethnic and cultural backgrounds who've taken up this charge to go out and educate ourselves and to educate our community, specifically communities of color, which we come from, that we feel a great deal of responsibility to. And while this plate's going around, I'm going to say a couple things. And the first thing I just want to say is that we, the people of this country, has always excluded and always been a tool to oppress people of color here in this country. So we recognize the shallow promise that is. And we try to go out and educate ourselves initially and our communities about the ills of globalization, imperialism, and colonization because our people have experienced those things. And we feel as though what Scott is talking about and what's happening around the world, particularly as this country exploits many different parts of the world, and this last illegal invasion taking place in Iraq and in Afghanistan, is just another manifestation of how this country views people, particularly people of color, oppressing them here in this country and taking that oppression and exporting it all across the globe. So that's the one thing I want to say about that just as people of color here, we recognize that we the people and how that tool's been used to oppress us here and how we're watching it oppress other people around the world. I also want to, while the plate's going around, I want to just give a special thanks to all the people who endorsed this function tonight, and I'm just going to read the names. And what I'm going to ask you to do is, there are these flyers here, and we'd like you to take them, and for the folks that weren't able to come here, specifically for people of color, organizers, activists, everyday people that you know, take some of these flyers and give them to them and let them know that we're around, because we want to continue to have these events, and we want to continue to talk to our communities, right? And we want to continue to mobilize our people and educate them. So I'm just going to read this list of names, and we'll get into the questions as the plate's going around. So these are all people who supported us tonight. The Coalition for Educational Justice, Coalition for World Peace, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, Community Coalition for Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment, the Garment Workers Center, ABI, Human Service Alliance, Humanitarian Law Project, the Indian Progressive Study Group, the Korean Immigrant Workers Advocates, the Labor Community Strategy Center, Mothers for an Aware America, the National Lawyers Guild, Los Angeles, Not in Our Name, the Philippine Human Rights Watch, Office of the Americas, Sweatshop Watch, and Youth Opportunities Unlimited Incorporated. So how about we give them a big round of applause for helping us bring this event out. All right, so if folks have questions or comments, if you could speak loud enough so the folks on the mic can pick it up and Scott can hear your questions.
What I wanted you to respond to was the idea of all troops out now and how you see that happening, because when I talk to my family members who are totally against the war, they really feel now that we have to stay in to make things okay now. So I'd like to have you respond to that.
Well, this is a no-brainer. A, we don't belong there. So how in the world could you possibly say that we have a right to continue to stay there? Forget the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party never constituted a threat to the people of the United States of America worthy of the intervention of American troops. I'm not saying the Ba'ath Party is a good organization. But the idea that we're going to bring democracy to Iraq is absurd in the extreme. You have to deal with foundations. We went into this war on false pretense. This war was never built on something solid. It's a violation of international law. Our continued occupation is a violation of international law. The situation's getting worse, not better. We are not going to win. So how long do your family members want American troops to die in Iraq? The question I ask them is, how big do you want the Iraq War Memorial to be? Where are their brains? And I don't mean to be insulting, but hey, I don't give a damn about their feelings. American boys and girls are dying, and they're killing Iraqi boys and girls. How big do we want the memorial to be? You know, in 1967, when many people recognized that Vietnam was a lost cause, a lot of people said we have to stay the course, keep the boys in there, reinforce, because we got to prevail. Well, we're not going to prevail in Iraq, and we didn't prevail in Vietnam. Imagine how small that black granite V carved into the ground in Washington, D.C. would be if people had said, hey, in 1968, we're getting out of this thing. We can't win. Or in 69, or in 70. You cut 1 year off that war. How many thousands of lives did you save? How big do you want the war memorial in Iraq to be? Because that's the only question that's there right now. The Ba'ath Party, we didn't defeat them. They're still there. How many people here think Saddam Hussein surrendered? Where's the great surrender of the Iraqi army? Where's the surrender of the Iraqi intelligence services? Where's the surrender of the Republican Guard and the Special Republican Guard? They didn't surrender. They simply melted away. They're still there, they're still resisting, and they're going to continue to resist. We've given a false promise, a false hope of democracy. But democracy, do we want democracy in Iraq? Really? If we had free vote in Iraq, 60% of the population who are Shia Muslim would vote for the installation of an Islamic Republic in Iraq right now. Donald Rumsfeld, who apparently is running the policy in Iraq, has said there will never be an Islamic Republic in Iraq. The Coalition Provisional Authority that's writing the fundamental law for Iraq is struggling against allowing Islam as the official religion of a Muslim country. We don't want democracy in Iraq. We want American-imposed hegemony, stability. And at the end of the day, the only stability that's going to come in Iraq is at the hands of the Sunni, i.e. the Ba'athists. So we kicked the Ba'athists out. But you know what we're doing right now? We're scrambling to get the Ba'athists back in. We demobilized the Ba'athist military, and now we see that there's no way to get a military up and running without going back to the Ba'athist troops. We got rid of 3 million Ba'athists who ran the country for 30 years, and now the country's not functioning. So we're bending over backwards to bring them back in. We're just going to call them something different than the Ba'athists. Why the hell did we go to war in Iraq to begin with? It's not about democracy. We're not going to win. We've already lost this war. It's just a question of how many troops we're going to lose before we realize this is a war that we cannot win, and we bring the troops home. So, confronted with the inevitability of the eventual return of American troops without achieving fundamental victory in Iraq, I say, why wait? Bring the troops home now.
We're now going to hear from a friend of mine and just this, a wonderful, wonderful performer, cultural activist named Olga Garcia, who's a community poet from East Los Angeles, who's been an educator for the past 10 years. And among Latinos for a long time, before we had any kind of written history, we often recorded our history and recorded our stories in either song or in the spoken word. And Olga has continued and expanded on that tradition to tell, I think, some incredibly important stories about our reality, about our struggles, about our aspirations. And I'm really pleased that she's here with us tonight to share this special gift. Olga Garcia.
Just want to thank Bill Gallegos for inviting me here tonight, and I think that the arts, poetry, music, and visual art is embedded in the movement, and I think it's important to continue to share our art and for it to be political art and to try to reach as many people as we can through all of the avenues that we have. I'm going to share a poem today. It doesn't have a title. If anybody at the end of the event has a title for me, I would be more than happy to take suggestions. And this is a poem that I wrote after September 11th, about a year after September 11th. And I think during that whole time period, immediately after September 11th, like so many people, so many other people, it was just so overwhelming. And I was so angry about so many things that were happening and the reactions, the emotional reactions from people and from in my workplace. I remember having flags put on my desk at work and being really upset about that. And just feeling that sense of censorship, not being able to really express yourself or say anything because people would automatically, you know, you were a terrorist, etc. And it took me a long time to write this poem because I was so upset about it, but in many ways I feel that it was something I needed to put down on paper. Today I do not want my words to be bullets. My language will not be another weapon in warfare. My metaphors, angry as they may be, will not fly like grenades or explode like bright colored cluster bombs. I, unlike my government, do not own or harbor weapons of mass destruction. I have no quest for the conquest of oil. Truth be told, I would rather be writing a poem about my grandmother planting seeds. I would rather be describing the red wing flower of my lover's embrace. I would rather be nostalgically searching for the missing syllables of my father in a haiku. Honestly, this bruised face of a poem did not want to be born into the 21st century. Not like this, not again. This is an old poem resurfacing like repressed memories, recalling this country's land soaked and drenched in Indian blood. This is such an old poem pointing to the thick scars of African bodies hanging and swaying on the branches of American trees. This is language. Langston Hughes's poem declaring America was never America to me. This is a poem that has witnessed Chinese exclusion, Japanese internment, Operation Wetback. This is an old poem that has not forgotten the seemingly forgotten names of Vietnam, Nicaragua, Grenada, the Philippines, Panama, El Salvador, Chile, Afghanistan. This is an old poem that has witnessed bullets entering bodies of 13-year-old boys throwing stones at military tanks in occupied territories. This is a poem recording the history of bulldozers crumbling homes and crushing skulls in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, recording the history of unlawful incarceration, secret deportations, the building of a Hooked on Fear TV nation. This is an old poem that has seen first world bullies threatened to ambush with ammunition, bombshells, fighter jets, rhetoric of terror to terrorize. You see, this is such an old poem. It's almost a cliche. And I would rather be sitting at the mouth of an ocean talking to the ghost of Storni, meditating on the verses of Gandhi. But I am vomiting this splintered song of a poem, trapped like a tangled scream in my throat, split open and raw in the chest. This is an imperative response to a plague, violence, violence. Violence will not silence this poem, surfacing like a prayer, surfacing like corpses in rivers and deserts, surfacing like wooden crosses, unmarked symbols for the dead. This is a poem standing in protest among arrogant stallions riding into another century, waving loaded guns, tomahawk missiles in the air. We have been here before. This is an old poem, a poem in mourning, in weeping over blood-stained flags, body bags for the few, mass graves for the many. The ghosts of the unnamed are gathering like a sandstorm in this poem. This is a poem in protest, in non-cooperation with the profiteers of war, in protest of pandemic propaganda, in protest of pipelines over people, in protest of patriotism that ignores the growing piles of bodies, men, women, and children whose names have not yet been pronounced. The post-traumatic war syndromes will not be televised. This is a poem in protest against pep rallies for battle, in protest of clapping hands, cheering voices on the sidelines. War is not a football game. This is not a cowboy movie. Iraq is not a video game. This is a poem in protest of euphemisms and non sequiturs. Just for the record, the emperor is not wearing new clothes. War is an intentional act of terrorism. Feeding a population you've purposefully starved and crippled does not make you a humanitarian. It makes you a hypocrite. This poem will not carry banners for conquest, Operation Just Cause, Operation Desert Storm, Operation Iraqi Freedom are hereby renamed Operation Corporate Greed, Operation Genocide, Operation Hegemony. Today, I do not want my words to be bullets. My language will not be another weapon in warfare. Today, I want my words to be more courageous than war. I want them to be obsidian mirrors, resilient blades of grass in the wind, a seed for change, an eye that speaks, a match that burns, a fist full of flowers held up to the sky in defiance of death and destruction. Thank you very much.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. You can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.